Okay, well, I'm going to officially greet each one of you, and it's good to see several of you made it back. I see a few other new faces, and that either indicates that our ranks have swelled, or I've just got a faulty memory, or didn't pay attention to who was here this morning. Anyway, it's good to have each of you here. And we're going to begin by asking the Lord's blessing on our program. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the opportunity to come together on a Sabbath afternoon as the Sabbath hours are winding up, and to turn our attention to more themes from the book of nature, from the greatest aspect of your creation on this planet, that is the human organism. Please help us to understand how to better care for ourselves and minister to other people, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the title of this afternoon's presentation is The Methuselah Factor. And an astute individual in the congregation came up to me and they said, Dr. DeRose, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I said, The Methuselah Factor. He said, yes, it's about how to live a long time. How many of you think that person was on the right track? That's exactly right. Methuselah, of course, the person who lived longest on this earth. Now, there's others that have lived longer than him, but they didn't live on this earth. Like Enoch, right? He was translated to heaven. But Methuselah was the longest lived person on this earth. And we're speaking about what I believe Methuselah must have had, among other things. He must have had a good Methuselah factor. Well, what is that? Well, let me give you a little bit of background, and that is throughout history, we're not just speaking in Bible lands, but throughout the world, people have wanted to understand how to turn back the clock. They've wanted to say, well, you know, I seem like I'm getting older, and the calendar keeps turning over every month after month. I just wish that I could turn back the clock and have some more vitality and more youth. And so there's legends throughout the world about people who longed to have some kind of fountain of youth, if you will. But actually, there's a medical science, a discipline of medicine, that is actually suggesting that there is something that although it may not turn back the clock fully, it can help us live longer and better. And that is what we're calling the Methuselah factor. It's something that can help you live longer and better. And the medical scientists don't call it the Methuselah factor. They call it hemoreology. Now, why do you think I like to call it the Methuselah factor? Yeah, we're going to speak together for an hour or so this afternoon. It would be embarrassing, wouldn't it, to go back home and someone say, well, where were you? And you say, oh, I heard this lecture at our church. It was so interesting. What was it about? It was about hemolononi. So we just let you call it the Methuselah factor if you can't get out hemoreology, okay? Or you can call it the H factor if you like. And this way of looking at our physiology is very interesting because it really holds the key to a number of the leading diseases that we deal with today. So just what is hemoreology? Well, these are some fancy definitions from medical textbooks, but simply put, hemoreology is just the science of blood fluidity. The science of blood fluidity. Because if blood flows better, you can have a healthier physiology. Now, hemoreology is all focused on the red blood cell and its ability to get around the body. Now, some years ago, I was in Europe. We were just there again doing some health programs this summer. But it was some years ago when I was actually driving in Europe. And we had a rental car, and we were driving down one of these European streets. And the street kept getting narrower and narrower and narrower as we're driving the car. And finally, I realized that one of two things was going to happen. That's right. Either I was going to scrape the car on one of the walls of the road, or I was going to back out. Those are the only two options, because it kept getting narrower and narrower. Because the diameter of my car was wider than the diameter of the road. Okay, can you follow along with this? Now, how many of you realize that in your bloodstream, the smallest roads, we call them the capillaries, are narrower than the diameter of your red blood cell? Did you know that? Your red blood cells are larger in diameter than the smallest blood cell's diameter, smallest blood vessel's diameter, the capillaries. So how can they get through? They literally have to squeeze through. Now, I suppose the evolutionist would say, well, this is just evidence that things just evolved by chance, because no engineer would make the road smaller than the vehicles. But this is actually a marvel of design, because as the blood cell squeezes through those capillaries, it maximizes the contact of the surface of the red cell with the lining of a capillary, and that's where the action takes place, where gases are transmitted back and forth, and the blood sugar is delivered. So God designed it that way. But if your blood fluidity is not optimal, those red blood cells will back up and you won't get optimal circulation. So hemorheology is the science of those blood cells getting most effectively through your system. So why is it important? Well, we've already been talking about it. It may seem obvious by this point, but one author years ago wrote these words, perfect health depends on perfect circulation. By the way, this is an amazing author who wrote it. Any of you know who it was? Someone by the name of Ellen White, years ahead of her time. I'm sure many people over the years, as they've read that, they said, oh, what poetry, what sweet poetry. But actually, this is not poetry. This is cutting-edge medical science. What Ellen White was speaking about was hemorheology. She said perfect health depends on perfect circulation. Is there medical evidence of this? Well, we have medical evidence that improved blood fluidity, better hemorheology, if you will, can help you prevent all of the diseases and more that are on this list. So all the diseases on this list and more can be prevented, or at least your risk can be decreased by optimal hemorheology. So we don't have time today to go through this whole list, but let me give you a few examples. And let's look at this one first, coronary artery disease. So this is one indicator of hemorheology. There's different measurements that we can make that give us an idea of blood fluidity. This one is called viscosity. Now, how many of you understand the concept of viscosity? Okay, I see a few of you are willing to admit it. I want you to be very observant, and I have a prop here with me. Some people are very creative. They have multiple props. I really only have a few. I want you to observe what's going to happen here. You have to watch very carefully. What happened just there? I drank water. How well did the water flow out of the bottle? Easily, right? I could, in fact, just pour this water out in just a moment. I could pour it all over the church. You probably wouldn't invite me back. But is the water very viscous? Does it have high or low viscosity? We actually say it has low viscosity, okay? So you could just, it pours very freely. Now, let's say we had filled this container up with honey, okay? How many of you think I could have poured the honey down my throat just as rapidly as I poured that water? No, and if I did, I would be sick, wouldn't I, if I took that much honey in. So honey is more viscous, okay? So viscosity is one measure of fluidity. So if we're looking at measuring blood fluidity, one of the things we can measure is viscosity, and that's what they did in this study. They took this population, it's a European study, and they divided them into quarters. And they're comparing the quarter with the lowest viscosity, that's the most freely flowing blood, like water, compared them with the highest viscosity. And look at the difference in the risk of having a heart event, like a heart attack. An over tripling of risk based on viscosity alone. So this is not looking at blood pressure, it's not looking at cholesterol, and I'm not saying some of those things don't factor into the equation, but it's looking only at this one measure, and that's viscosity. The more viscous the blood, the greater your risk of having a heart attack. Well, what about cancer? You say, I mean, pretty obvious, strokes on the list, we could have looked at that data, coronary artery disease, you say, oh, well, yeah, that's obvious. If the blood doesn't flow as well, you can get blockage in the blood vessels, and the blood oxygen can't get to the heart. But could cancer be related to blood fluidity? Well, indeed it is. And here's just one example. This is a study of female cancers. So these researchers are looking at women who are about to have surgery for female cancers. And when they measured their blood viscosity again, they found something very interesting. Do you see it there? They found that the worst viscosity, the highest viscosity, had the greatest risk of clots, thrombosis, blockage in the arteries or the veins, in both ovarian and cervical cancer patients. And they said, well, that's obvious, Dr. DeRose. What's so interesting about that? If the blood doesn't flow as smoothly, sure, you're going to be more likely to have clots. But here's what was really interesting. They found that viscosity was also a significant risk factor for survival. So why would that be? Why would, if the blood didn't flow as smoothly, why would that put you at higher risk of death from cancer? Well, here's what the researchers said. They said in gynecologic cancer patients, and I'll try to translate it because it's just right from the medical literature, a combination of an increase in RBC aggregation, that's the stickiness of the red blood cells, and plasma viscosity, so these are two things that affect blood fluidity. So in other words, they're saying bad hemorheology, that's a combination of increase in RBC aggregation and plasma viscosity. It impairs blood flow properties and may induce hypoxia, that's lack of oxygen in the microcirculation in the tiny blood vessels. And this favors thrombosis, that's clotting, and that allows tumor cells to settle in those little tiny clots and set up what we call metastasis. What they're saying is if your blood is not flowing smoothly throughout the body, tiny little clots can form in your arteries, cancer cells can lodge in those clots, and they can be isolated from your immune system for long enough for the cancer to set a foothold and spread. That's what they're saying. So they say if you measure blood fluidity, you're measuring an indicator of cancer risk. And there's other studies showing that blood fluidity may increase, if it's poor, may increase your risk of getting cancer in the first place. So just giving you some examples. How about cognitive decline? Do you think your mental functioning is related to blood fluidity? Well, the research shows it is. Here's an example. The lower your plasma viscosity, the quicker your reaction speed, the better your brain works. And they actually showed that something called venesection could improve the mental alertness of many people. Any of you know what venesection is? It's taking blood from you. Okay? Now, I find this very interesting. I do a whole series sometimes that I call Ancient Secrets, Modern Health. Ancient Secrets, Modern Health. And You know, we make fun of a lot of people in antiquity, even if antiquity wasn't all that long ago, and we say how stupid they were. We make fun of other cultures, and we say they were, you know, led by the devil or doing all these stupid things. But actually, and I'm not saying the devil hasn't had a hand in many things, in the, quote, healing arts throughout the world. But if something has been perpetuated in a culture for centuries, there's almost always some sound physiologic basis behind it, even if it's gotten mixed up with a lot of error. Can any of you think of a place in the world where they used to practice venesection as a therapeutic agency? Yeah, right here in the U.S. There's actually a wonderful book about the history of the Adventist health message. It's called The Story of Our Health Message by D.E. Robinson. Have you ever read that book? It's actually really worth reading. I don't know if it's in print, but I know, actually, if you get my email address at the end of the program, I think I might even be able to get you a free electronic copy of the book. The Story of Our Health Message, D.E. Robinson was actually, and some of you are Adventist historians, you can correct me if I don't have this quite right, but he was one of Ellen White's secretaries and also married his granddaughter, I believe. Does that sound right to some of you? D.E. Robinson? Some of you are nodding your heads, acting like you know, and hopefully you do, because I acted like I knew when I told you that. But none of you corrected me, so we'll take it at face value. Maybe one of you is checking this on some Adventist historical site. But so D.E. Robinson, very closely connected with Ellen White, wrote this book called The Story of Our Health Message. But as I recall, the opening chapter was something like The Times of Our Ignorance, and he shared the story of George Washington and how many people believe he was bled to death. But why were people bleeding people? Why were doctors bleeding people? Was it just a stupid idea of balancing the humors or getting out the bad, you know, blood? There was actually true physiology behind it, you see, because many people, if you take a little bit of blood away, it improves their hemorheology, and no doubt doctors had experience with taking some blood from someone and they felt better and they did better. The problem was, just because a little is good doesn't mean a lot is better. You following along? And you actually need hemoglobin to live. So they took enough away, and then you would die from profound anemia. We would call it shock, okay? So anyway, lowering your blood viscosity, making your blood fluidity better by blood donation to the doctor, venesection, could improve your mental performance. Very interesting. What about diabetes? Any relationship with blood fluidity? Well, by now you probably guessed the answer is yes. And it's true. This is just a title from one of the medical journals. Basically, they're saying that if you don't get enough oxygen to the kidney, this can cause kidney damage. And one of the things that affects oxygenation of the kidney is blood fluidity. So now you say, well, we're all interested, Dr. DeRose. How good is my hemorheology? How good is my H factor? So how many of you are hoping that I brought my medical team here with me and we're going to sell the hemorheology test for half price after the lecture? How many of you are happy to know that? Well, I actually brought no such team. We're not going to measure anything because really, think about it. No matter what your blood fluidity is, shouldn't we all be trying to have it as optimal as possible, right? So let's say we checked all your, measured your blood viscosity and other things, and you had the best in the room. So should you just say, hey, well, great, I can coast. You know, now I can eat more saturated fat and drink less water. I'm starting to give you some ideas of some of the things that might help your hemorheology, but those are things that make it worse. No matter where you stand, we, I think, all should want to do all we can to improve our blood fluidity. And that's what we want to look at in the rest of our time together. What natural things can we do to improve our blood fluidity? Well, let's talk about that. here's the list, and we'll look at some of these things in more detail. Drink plenty of water. Don't smoke or use other tobacco products. Exercise regularly. Control your other heart disease risk factors. These have an impact on your blood fluidity. Eat an abundance of whole plant foods. By the way, I appreciated all the hard work that went into the fine menu today at church. If you didn't stay by, you missed something. If you weren't here, you missed something. By the way, how often do you do that here? Almost every Sabbath, this young man says. Someone else says twice a month. So here's what I would recommend. I would recommend if you don't have a place to eat on Saturday, show up here. No, really. They did a very, very excellent job. Get adequate amounts of vitamin D year-round. Get adequate sleep every night. Make dental health a priority. Achieve and maintain an ideal weight. Control stress. And donate blood. These are all things you can do to improve your blood fluidity. Well, let's talk about some of them. Drink plenty of water. Some of you were here this morning. We talked about this. Others of you weren't. They tell me that they recorded the presentation and that it will be available on the website. Is that just a rumor or is that true? Okay, I see nods saying it's true. So if you didn't hear that, we spoke about some of the data on water drinking and decreasing your risk of a heart attack and stroke. So we featured that this morning, so we'll leave it at that. But if you want the practical take-home message when it comes to water, well, just think about it. Maybe you could crystallize in your own words what the practical message about water drinking would be. And I'll just let you reflect on that for a few moments. Think about what the message might be about water, okay? Anyone like to come up with a synthesis of what we talked about? Okay, that was a good synthesis. But if you didn't hear it, you can just simply say, drink more water. Okay? By the way, can you drink too much? Yes, everyone knows you can drink too much. Well, how much is too much? What does the medical research indicate? If you don't have any heart or kidney problems, you're not on any medications that affect your fluid balance or your electrolytes, how much water would it take, pure water, to do you harm or serious damage, let's put it that way? Yeah, for someone it may be 1 or 2 gallons, but for most people it's in the range of 4 gallons, okay? So most people, no problem drinking 1 or 2 gallons a day, but once you get in that 4 or 5 gallon range, that's dangerous. And the big danger is something called dilutional hyponatremia. Now, again, don't try to see if you can, you know, get 3 gallons. Don't see how much water you can drink how quickly. Less than 1 gallon quickly could do you in. But over the course of a 24-hour period, you can actually handle quite a bit of water. The reason I tell you that is it's not like if you drink 8 glasses, it's good, but 9, you're going to die. So it's, you don't have to say, oh, no, I lost count today. Did I already have my 8? Or, is Dr. Bryant here? I don't want to drink that next glass because if I go, into a heart rhythm problem, I want someone around here who can resuscitate me, okay? So it's not that critical. Now, if you have heart failure, if you have kidney problems, it may be much less. Well, let's move on. Don't smoke or use other tobacco products. Oh, everybody knows this, right? Everybody knows they shouldn't smoke. It is surprising to me how many people still smoke in America. There are millions of them. As some of you know, I have a weekly radio show. It's called American Indian Living. And it's themed especially for Native Americans. But we've noticed something over the years. Native Americans are people just like African Americans and European Americans, and Australian Americans. And you following along with me? And they tend to be interested in the same things that everyone else is. So we have a lot of topics on the show that everybody's interested in. Now, sometimes we might talk about something on some tribal land, some topic of special interest to Native Americans, but many of the times our shows feature things of interest to everyone. Why I'm telling you that is I recently conducted an interview within the last week or two with a Dr. Stanton Glantz. Dr. Glantz is at UCSF, University of California at San Francisco. He's one of the leading researchers in the world on tobacco. And Dr. Glantz was telling us on the interview, it'll be aired probably in January, he was telling us about the big concern in research circles about two things that are growing in popularity in America that seem to be very dangerous, by some measures, more dangerous than tobacco smoke. As far as the heart effects, some of the early data that we have, the heart effects of marijuana smoke are much worse than tobacco smoke. The effect on the blood vessels. It's a very interesting research that's being done. And the other thing that is emerging as very dangerous are these e-cigarettes. So people are thinking that they're doing something better, but really, you know, God designed us to breathe fresh air. And if you're breathing any kind of volatilized particles, this is not good, okay? As few things, burned things especially, superheated things, okay? You don't. Now, sure, there might be a therapeutic role for eucalyptus in the steam during for an infection, okay? A therapeutic effect for something that's medicinal. But neither tobacco nor marijuana for the lungs has any benefits that I am aware of, okay? Well, don't smoke or use other tobacco products. Smoking really damages blood fluidity in a number of ways, and it increases your white blood cell count. The higher your white count, the poorer your blood fluidity. There's another chemical called fibrinogen. Fibrinogen is a clotting protein. If you smoke, it will raise your fibrinogen levels, and it will make your blood less fluid. So these are just two ways that smoking worsens your blood fluidity, and even a single cigarette will do it, even a single cigarette. Now, this is an interesting study from Japan. And they were looking at over 16,000 Japanese women. And what I want you to notice is they noticed just what we were saying, that as you smoke more, your white blood cell count goes up, and then something very interesting happens. As your white cell count goes up, insulin works less well in the body. And you might say, well, that's not surprising, because if you don't get good circulation to your tissues, insulin can't get to your cells. And what the root cause of diabetes in most cases is, type 2 diabetes, the root cause is insulin resistance. So if you have diabetes, if your blood sugar is not as good as you would like it, you need to be concerned about what? That's right, the Methuselah factor. Is that what you said up front? That's exactly right. You need to be concerned about your blood fluidity. Because if you can make your blood more fluid, you can get tissues in your body better oxygenated. And when that happens, everything improves. That's what they found. Higher white cell counts predict worse blood sugars and frank type 2 diabetes. This is actually looking at the risk of pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. IFG is impaired fasting glucose. We now call that pre-diabetes. And what you see here, as the white count goes up, what happens? Higher risk of diabetes and pre-diabetes as the white count goes up. If you have a smoking history, your risk is even higher in general. Yeah, the point is here, there seem to be still some adverse effects of those years of smoking on the physiology. Okay? So the person here with a white count of, let's say, 8,000, these are in thousands, white counts. So this is 7.2 thousand. So 8,000 is above 7.2. So in this category, if you compare them with a lower wife count, those who are ex-smokers have over triple the risk of developing diabetes, type 2 diabetes, or impaired fasting glucose. Well, that doesn't mean you throw up your hands in dismay, but you actually say, I want to get my wife count down. Let me tell you a true story. Some years ago, I got a call from someone across the country. It was a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. He had just been to his doctor. The doctor checked his blood count, and his white count was about 3,500. So it was down here. And the doctor said, I'm very worried. I'm very worried about your diet. You're a vegan, and you need to start eating meat to get your white blood cell count up. Okay. And he was calling me. He was asking me what I thought of this. And I said, oh, you don't need to start eating meat. I said, I know a better way to get your white count up. I said, start smoking. Now, he realized I was not quite serious, but I was making a point. You see, the white blood cells in your body are like the police cars in your body. If I follow along with this, okay? You're here at the Three Angels Church right now, right? So how many of you drove more than 20 miles to get here? Okay, so you have a number of hands. So let's say as you start driving home after the program tonight, you're driving home, and you start seeing more and more police cars. Okay? And as you're getting closer and closer to your house, the police cars are just all over. How many of you are starting to think, I am so glad they are stepping up police protection in our neighborhood? This is so reassuring. What are you thinking? Something's wrong. This is exactly right. If you have a high white count, your body is being put on alert. You're feeding all these bad chemicals, these meat proteins into your body, and your body's saying this is bad. You're giving it tobacco smoke. Your body's saying this is bad. We need to ramp up our defenses, and so you have a high white count. The pastor with the white count of 3,500, he was perfectly healthy. This was good. He wasn't in any problem. If he would be exposed to an infection, his white count would go up to fight the infection. His white count just wasn't being stimulated every day by his diet and other lifestyle practices. Do you see the point? So a low white count, if that's what it runs for you, that's good. And that's what the research shows. So don't let anyone scare you into eating meat, thinking that that's going to raise your white count like that's something good. Actually, it's very interesting and very important to understand this because I've worked in lifestyle programs over the years, and I can almost guarantee that every patient who comes, their white count's going to go down. And when if I'd see someone come in with a white count of 5,000, I'd often tell them, you know, your white count's going to, it may actually be below the normal range when you finish the program and we'd explain this. You know how the white blood cells are not good to have lots of them. Sure, if you have an infection, you want more of them, but you don't want them every day floating around in your body because they make your blood less fluid and increase your risk of all these problems. Well, we're going to hasten on. The point is that high white counts, one of the things that raise it is smoking. Smoking also does something else that many smokers don't realize. It increases the risk dramatically of dementia. This is a large study about a decade ago from Australia, and they found if a person was a smoker, just at a point in time, they had nearly double the risk of having Alzheimer's. You can see a 79% increased risk. And then there's a cousin of Alzheimer's, cousin in the sense that it causes dementia in large numbers of people, but it is not Alzheimer's. It's what we call vascular dementia. It's from circulatory problems to the brain. Smoking also increases your risk of that. So if you want to bring your mind to an early senescence, one of the best things you can do is smoke. Now sometimes, I actually had a smoker in my office not all that long ago. He was not all that motivated by heart disease and cancer, but when I started to talk about dementia, he got very concerned. You see? So someone might say, well, who cares, you know, whether I die when I'm 80 or 90? I mean, there's a lot of people in their 50s that say that, but not too many 79-year-olds do I hear saying that. But what about dementia? How many of you would like to spend the last, you know, 10, 15 years of your life severely demented? Now, I know, as the pastor pointed out, he said to me, "Dr. DeRose, are you okay with speaking to the choir this afternoon?" And I think he was saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, since the choir had just been practicing. But I realize that probably not too many of you in this room are cigarette smokers. But if you are, and if no one knows about it, or you think no one knows about it, there's help for you. God can help you stop smoking. Do you believe it? Yes, He can. But it takes a decision. You have to make up your mind. You have to realize that this really is harmful, and you really are undermining the health of your body temple. Well, if you follow smokers over time, that's what this is showing. Not only at any point in time, if you check, smokers will have higher rates of dementia. Those who keep smoking have higher risks of dementia over time. Just bad stuff. Well, let's talk about exercise. So we've talked about something that was good, drinking more water, then something was bad, not smoking, now something that's good again, and that's regular physical exercise. I was glad to see a number of you, even though it stayed by, you were out getting some exercise between your choir practice and lunch. Just a great thing to do. Get out and just move. Exercise actually helps to improve blood fluidity, and the more exercise you get, the better your blood fluidity tends to be. And in fact, one of the things that exercise helps you with is decreasing body fat, and less body fat helps blood fluidity. A lot of people don't realize this, but body fat is metabolically active. Fat makes inflammatory compounds. And so that the extra weight that you carry is not just something you're lugging around, but it's actually undermining your physiology. Now, I know sometimes people get discouraged because there might be someone here that weighs more than what they think their ideal weight is. But, you know, sometimes I've found in dealing with patients over the years is that someone that objectively you might think is overweight might be on a very good lifestyle. We can't judge anyone else. If they weren't so careful, they might weigh 500 or 600 pounds, okay? And they only weigh, you know, 280 right now. So here's the interesting thing, though. Even if you don't lose a pound, physical exercise can help you. And it can help you in the area of blood fluidity. This was an interesting study published some years ago by a group that really started the dialogue on fitness versus fatness. This is out of the Cooper Clinic in Dallas, Texas. Some of you may have heard of Kenneth Cooper, the so-called father of aerobics. He invented that term, aerobics, to describe exercises that use large muscle groups like running or swimming or cycling. So Cooper's group has been studying exercise for decades, and they started this dialogue probably 15, 20 years ago about fitness and fatness. And basically it boils down to a question. If you had to choose between being thin and unfit and fit and fat, which should you choose? What would the average American choose? Well, the average American, you know, they would probably choose to be thin and unfit, right? And in fact, they'd say, it's unfair. You know, my sister doesn't do anything. She just sits around all day and, you know, she has the perfect figure, the perfect weight. She can eat anything she wants. And here I am, you know, I've got 50 extra pounds and I'm exercising every day and I'm on a vegan diet. I even go to the Three Angels Church. Okay? And that hasn't helped me yet. So who's really better off? What did the research show? The research showed that actually those who were overweight and fit were better off than the thin and unfit people. So instead of feeling jealous of your sister, you should feel sorry for her that she doesn't have a reminder every time she gets on the scale that she needs to exercise more. Okay? Really, it's very interesting. A lot of the things that that seem to be curses are really blessings. We wrote about this in our book, 30 Days to Natural Blood Pressure Control. Told a story there about diabetes. A couple of patients that I had many years ago, they were both in their 70s, and they both had had type 1 diabetes for decades. Okay? They were quite healthy, both these women. But they came to a lifestyle center at the same time. I think that's why their stories just resonated with me, and I remember them to this day. Because not only were they both in their 70s and healthy, there was some unique characteristic about these two women in comparison to the rest of their families. Anyone want to guess what it was? They had actually both outlived everyone in their family. And they had type 1 diabetes from an early age. Well, how could that be? Well, as we talked about it in 30 Days to Natural Blood Pressure. By the way, if you don't have the book, we're going to be giving you the high points of the book tomorrow. Okay? So tomorrow at 2:15, if you haven't registered, you can come right here, right next door. In the, what do you call that room? The Fellowship Hall. We will be having a presentation about an hour or so, is that right? On natural strategies for blood pressure. I won't tell this story, probably. So you're getting a bonus right now. So you know, if you see someone there, say you missed out, you've got to listen to the recordings from the church services we have. But we'll be talking in detail about this tomorrow, so you don't have to get the book. You can get the high points of the 12 or 13 hour book. I know that it takes 12 or 13 hours to read through the book. How do you think I know that? Yeah, because I read the book. We have it on audiobook. So I read through the whole book. It's 12 and a half, 13 hours of audio. So we won't be able to cover all that in an hour. Some of you told me this morning that I spoke too fast for you to keep up with. Don't worry, I won't speak 12 times as fast as I normally do to cover all the material in the book. But just an invitation to you. Tomorrow, 2:15. If you pre-registered, yes, there's a meal at 1:30. But that's coming up tomorrow. So back to our two ladies in their 70s. Outlived everyone in their family. And then here's why. Here's what happened. And I just, in my mind's eye, as I met these two women, they were both very careful with their lifestyle. I could imagine what was happening. Growing up, the family members were saying, oh, poor Julie. You know, she can't eat all the cake and ice cream. Oh, poor Julie, it's cold out. She's got to go out and exercise for diabetes. Oh, we're all watching the movie on TV, and she's out in the cold. It's 45 degrees out. She has to wear a coat and exercise. What a poor thing. Her youth just being robbed from her. Can you imagine those kind of... Really, it's amazing. You know, poor girl, she... Oh, you can't have soda pop and cake and ice cream? You have to eat what? More vegetables. Oh, poor girl. Well, what happened to these poor girls? Yeah, they lived longer because they learned how to live with their disease. So instead of looking at our liabilities as things that, you know, God forgot us, God didn't give us very good genes, no, we take what God gave us and He'll help us to live as healthy as possible. Now, you may never be what you think is the ideal weight. You may never have what you think is the ideal IQ. You may never be able to run as fast a mile as you would like. I don't know what things you're measuring, right? Right? But, or walk, okay, but here's the point. You do, you can walk a little bit. But you know what? I appreciate it because my wife told me, and she's very smart. She said, the smartest students sit up in the front row. Yeah, so you got the front row seat. So look at this now. Let's look at this. They're going to look now, these researchers, at some connections between exercise and weight. And this is a graphic. Now, it's a little bit complicated. I'll try to explain it to you. It's a 3D graphic. So what they're looking at, I'm going to make it a little bit simpler than it is. If some of you can kind of read this with your medical background, you might see that I'm oversimplifying it a little bit. But here's the fitness level down here. This is fitness. And here is weight. And these are the fibrinogen levels here. Okay? It's actually percentages with high fibrinogen, but that's what. Look at this. Who is the worst off in this graphic? Well, what you see here, it's the people with low fitness and obesity. You see, they're... Boy, this pointer is hard to work, especially when I stick my finger in front of it. Okay, right here. So these people have low fitness and they're obese. But I want you to notice something. If you get to a high fitness level, your fibrinogen level really is pretty much the same, whether you're obese or whether you're at normal weight. So the point is, when it comes to fibrinogen, remember, this is one determinant of hemorheology, one determinant of blood fluidity. These people here, bad blood fluidity. Down here, good blood fluidity based on fibrinogen. And you can see, if you're highly fit, your weight really doesn't make much difference. So don't stop your exercise program because you're not losing weight. It's still benefiting you, and it's benefiting you tremendously as far as blood fluidity. Now someone's greatly reassured, and they said, see, I don't need to lose weight after all, honey. It's just fine that I weigh 600 pounds, by the way. I know that's no one here. And I don't need to try to lose even a pound. Dr. DeRose said, as long as I'm fit, I don't have to worry about it. Well, we told you that white blood cell count was another determinant of blood fluidity. And what you see here is, even if you're highly fit, being obese puts you at higher risk of a high white count than even someone who is at low fitness and at normal weight. So it changes here. So the point is, it's important to try to get your weight down as best you can, but it's also important to exercise even if you don't lose weight. Do you see both those messages coming out? Let me make one other point here, and I think it's especially important in a church. Tomorrow we're going to speak about high blood pressure. I think we're all oriented to that, right? You've got that reality. High blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. A lot of people wonder why they are prone to it. We now know that one of the things that predisposes us to metabolic disease is what was happening to us when we were in the womb. You get the picture? Your mother is pregnant with you. What's happening to your mother during her pregnancy is going to affect you. You can be pre-programmed to a high risk of diabetes or obesity or high blood pressure. By the way, what did you have to do with what was happening to your mother during pregnancy? Yeah, some of you say nothing. I mean, your mother may have blamed you for kicking her a lot at night and she didn't sleep well, but really you didn't have anything to do with it, right? When it comes to high blood pressure, let me just give you an example. So we're giving you some bonus material that we probably won't talk about tomorrow. During the 28th week of pregnancy to 34th week of pregnancy, in those later kind of stages, mid to later stages of pregnancy, your kidney's developing. If your mother was stressed during that time of kidney development, your kidneys may not have developed properly. By actual measurement, some people have twice as many filtering units in their kidney as others. They're born with twice as many. The fewer filtering units we have, we call them nephrons, the fewer filtering units, the greater you are predisposed to high blood pressure. So what did you have to do with that? So if you come tomorrow, or if you get our book, 30 Days to Natural Blood Pressure Control, or you get some of our videos on blood pressure, don't go through and, you know, see all the principles and say, I knew Sally Mae, that lady in the church, I knew that she wasn't following all that good lifestyle because she has high blood pressure. If she had listened to Dr. DeRose, she'd be exercising, she'd be on a vegan diet, and she's probably eating, you know, candy and, you know, stuff in the middle of the night, and et cetera, et cetera. No, we can't judge anyone. You see, we don't know not only their genetics, we also don't know their early life history, including what happened in the womb. So we can't judge anyone else, right? In fact, like I said, some people who are doing very well when it comes to lifestyle still have lifestyle-related diseases. Let me give you one other example. You already gathered I work a lot with Native Americans because I host a weekly radio show. I've been doing it for some 15 years, American Indian Living. You can listen to it online. There are Native American children who have type 2 diabetes. We used to call it adult onset diabetes. They're 5 or 6 years old. If those children had been exposed to a better lifestyle, they might have staved off the diagnosis and the development of diabetes maybe until they were 30 or 40. You following along with me? So they may never have been able to avoid it totally, but they could delay its onset. And so that's the message. Some things we may be predisposed to, we can't avoid entirely, but we could delay their arrival. Well, let's hasten on to a few other things. Most of you have heard it's important to get these numbers down. And by the way, the kind of lifestyle that you've been hearing about in Czech Wellness, the kind of things we've talked about already today, can help you. And some of these factors, like this one here, can actually lower your cholesterol, lower your triglycerides, improve your blood sugar. And that's getting on a whole food plant diet. That is the superior diet for health. Now, you know, people have told me over the years, they say, Dr. Droz, I know that's the ideal lifestyle, but I'm healthy. You know, I don't have diabetes. I don't have high blood pressure. Yeah, I've got maybe some extra weight or whatever. Maybe I don't even have that. So I'm a semi-vegetarian. They actually use that definition in the Adventist Health Study. A semi-vegetarian eats animal products less than once a week. You know, eats meat, fish, dairy, things like that. But the meat consumption, the fish, the poultry, less than once a week in each of those categories. They get benefits, but they don't get as much benefit in other things. I'll show you a graphic tomorrow if you're here. If not, it's in chapter 5 of the book. It's also in our video, Reversing Hypertension Naturally. And I may even tell this story again tomorrow because it's a memorable one. I was in a public venue, forget whether it was a church or a grocery store or something. Someone came up to me, Dr. DeRose, I came to your lecture, you know, it was 6-8 months ago. I came to your lecture, it changed my whole life. Now, how many of you think there might have been some temptation for me to feel proud at that point? Well, there wasn't, because the next thing out of this man's mouth was, but it was nothing that you said. Okay, so how did his whole life change by coming to a lecture? I showed him a graphic. Showed everyone this graphic, and you'll see it tomorrow. If not, you talk with me afterward. We'll have some of the books here, and I can even show you the page. And we're not trying to sell you the book. You can take a picture with your smartphone. Just don't tell my wife. She's the business manager. And, you know, you could take that with you. So here's the deal. It's a graphic of increasing animal product consumption. And what happens is, as you increase your animal product consumption, your risk steadily increases of both diabetes and high blood pressure. So if you go the other way, if you go from a omnivore, you know, typical American diet, eating kind of everything, to a semi-vegetarian, just cut back on your animal products dramatically, you'll lower your risk 20-30% of developing diabetes or high blood pressure. Get rid of all the fish, get rid of all the chicken and red meat, and you'll lower your risk further. Get rid of all the fish, you'll lower your risk further. Get rid of all the milk and eggs, you'll lower your risk further. Now here's the question. We'll probably share some data like this tomorrow, but if today you're alive and don't have high blood pressure, what are the odds of having high blood pressure by the time you get into your 80s? If you're just like the average American, do you know what your risk is? It's in the range of 90%. Okay? So here's my point. Don't wait until you have diabetes or high blood pressure or a heart attack to change your lifestyle. By the way, sometimes it's too late. You know, there are people that are diagnosed with diabetes when they're in kidney failure. There are people that are diagnosed with a heart attack and they die from the heart attack. Following along? So the point is, get serious about improving your blood fluidity Because it's not just decreasing your risk of diabetes and heart attack and high blood pressure, all those things. Hemorheology feeds in all these things. But it also is improving your cognitive function. You say, Dr. DeRose, the thing I don't like about this is you're just going to make a bunch of healthier sinners. That's all you're going to do. Well, let me ask you a question. How does God communicate with you? How does God communicate with you? Yeah, some of you are saying through your brain, right? Whether it's the words of the Bible, whether it's the preacher speaking, whether it's the Holy Spirit speaking to your heart, whether it's seeing providence around you, the Holy Spirit speaks through your brain. And the more clear your brain, the better you can hear God's voice. So even if you say, Dr. DeRose, I don't care whether I die when I'm 60 or whether I live to 100. I don't care. Well, but be concerned about your service for your Creator, your ability to walk with God and hear His voice. And if you have better blood fluidity, you'll do that. Well, eat more of those plant foods. That'll do it. If you want to have the best blood fluidity, you want to get more of those plant foods. And you'll lower all kinds of bad things in your blood when you eat more plants. You'll also be increasing your intake of healthy phytochemicals, plant chemicals. I'm going to tell you tomorrow about a very exciting one, and we have some very exciting information that I learned about when I started researching high blood pressure in more detail some years ago, just fascinating about plant foods and how they can help you. Well, I think we've made that point. In the sake of time, we'll make just one other point for you. And that is, there are other things that worsen blood fluidity that are found in animal products, and that's the fat found in animal products tends to make blood fluidity worse. It actually even makes your cell membranes more rigid. So the less animal products you eat, the better. Now, I'm not speaking to you as someone who was raised a vegetarian. I did not know a vegetarian growing up. I never heard of such a person, okay? And God got my attention as a young adult and directed me to a healthier lifestyle. And I'll tell you the truth, at first I didn't like it. Okay? I'm just being honest with you. I did not rejoice when I started learning these things because I realized God was asking me to change my lifestyle. In fact, I'll go this far and tell you I felt that God was kind of messing up my life. You ever felt that way? But I knew God was convicting me to change my lifestyle. And by His grace, I changed my lifestyle. Now, I was not a particularly sickly person, but I noticed within a couple years that my health was much better after making those changes. And so what was God trying to do? Was He trying to take away things from me that I enjoyed? Was that His motivation? No, what was He trying to do? He was trying to bless me, okay? Maybe you heard that story before of the woman who was being chased by a truck driver. Did you ever hear that story? That high-speed chase, and I think it was up in the roads of Wisconsin, woman being chased by a guy driving a tractor-trailer truck in the dark of night in rural Wisconsin. Finally, she came to a place where she thought there might be someone up at that late hour. She jumped out of her car, and the trucker jumped out immediately behind her, started running toward her. And next thing she knew, though, the trucker was pulling a man out of the back seat of her car. Someone had hidden in her car and was planning to do something evil to her. And as the trucker was driving by, he saw this man in her car and ended up following her to save her. But she was running away from the trucker. Why? She thought he was going to do something bad. He was just trying to save her from something that was already in her car that was, could have killed her. So here Jesus is trying to do what for us? He's trying to get all these things out of our life that are messing us up. And what are we doing? Well, you guys aren't doing it because you're here. You know, some people didn't come. They said, I'm not going to another health lecture because that doctor is just going to tell me all the things I'm doing wrong, and then I'm going to feel like I have to change. But no, why does God reveal life to us when it comes to healthful living? Why? It's to bless us. Okay, when we catch that, it just changes the whole equation. I have a talk that I give. It's a couple of talks. We call it Changing Bad Habits for Good. And we talk about this whole amazing way that God has created us with the ability to develop new enjoyments. He's not trying to take stuff away. He's trying to bless us. And once we understand it, when I understood it, that I could develop an enjoyment for living any way, well, I said, well, why not just pick the best way, right? If I can enjoy any way, you know, why don't I just make change? And I've made a lot of changes in my life, probably some I still need to make. So none of us have fully arrived. Well, omega-3 fats are fats that are actually good for your blood fluidity. And true or false, where omega-3 fats come in nature, they're made in nature by fish. Is that true? Could be a trick question. Are they made in nature by fish? Some say yes. Remember, I said it was a trick question. They are not made by fish. Omega-3 fats in nature are only made by plants. It just so happens that some fish that eat plants and phytoplankton and things like that concentrate the omega-3 fats in their tissues. But omega-3 fat is not fish fat. It's plant fat. And you can get all the omega-3 fat you need from plant sources. We might even talk more about that tomorrow. Anyway, it is a plant fat family. And omega-3 fats can help you lower your blood fluidity, make it better. By the way, if you are a total vegetarian, you should be taking a B12 supplement. And maybe I should even mention, for those of you that say you're still using milk and eggs because you don't want to get B12 deficiency, that's not a guarantee. Actually, the majority of people in America, the greatest number of people with B12 deficiency, even eat meat. Okay? So eating meat and dairy doesn't protect you from B12 deficiency. It does decrease your risk. It's kind of a complicated concept, and I know we need to wind up here very quickly. But here's my point. If you are a total vegetarian, you should be taking a B12 supplement. And if you are getting older, okay, you're still quite young. Let's say you're, you know, still quite youthful. Maybe you're in your 50s or 60s. You should be taking a B12 supplement too. And some of you that are entering the prime of life, you know, in your 70s and 80s, you should definitely be taking it. Okay? By the way, have you any of you noticed this? The prime of life has continued to change. As I age, my perspective on this topic changes. So I didn't mean to exclude any of you who are quite a bit younger, but you get my point. Vitamin D, very important for blood fluidity. And here we are. What latitude are we at here? 38, 40, what is it in Wichita? Any of you know? I'm just guessing. 37 and a half. That was said very authoritatively. So that's correct, huh? Okay. So you're actually at a latitude higher than most people believe you can make adequate vitamin D during the winter. So what that means is probably a few months out of the year, you have to get vitamin D as a supplement. If you go further north to Boston, that's 4 months of the year. Even if you go out in the sun doesn't come up high enough above the horizon for the ultraviolet B rays to get through the ozone, through the atmosphere, and make vitamin D in your skin. If you go to Bergen, Norway, which is where my wife's father was born, 6 months of the year, they could not make adequate vitamin D. Get adequate sleep every night. You want to have good blood fluidity. Some of you are quick learners, and I've noticed during my talks today, some of you have been sleeping. So you get, you know, some gold stars for being some of the sharper ones in the audience. This is a really interesting slide. This is a study about a decade ago from the Archives of Internal Medicine. And what I want you to notice here, these are some of the most powerful factors involved in inflammatory conditions. So if you know someone who has an inflammatory disease like rheumatoid arthritis or ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or lupus, or, you know, the list goes on and on, these things that they put these commercials on to advertise these drugs that cost thousands and thousands of dollars, well, I could just imagine a scenario where someone, in order to get this drug, these drugs, are working three jobs. And here's what happens. Many of these drugs work on things like interleukins. This is interleukin 6. This is tumor necrosis factor. So these powerful drugs are lowering levels of these compounds. But what this graphic is showing you is if you're cutting yourself short on sleep, your body is ramping up these inflammatory compounds. So maybe the person should quit those three jobs, get off their medicine, and just start sleeping 8 hours a night, and they would drop their interleukin 6 dramatically, over threefold. They drop their tumor necrosis factor naturally just by doing what? Sleeping more. Isn't that crazy? By the way, I had a guest some years ago on my radio show. She had written a book. She's a physician. She wrote a book. Guess what the title of the book was? Sleep Away the Pounds. Sleep Away the Pounds. She was presenting the medical evidence showing that one of the things that's perpetuating obesity in America is lack of sleep. You say, well, wait, I mean, I have lack of sleep, but that should, you know, raise my metabolism. No, it actually increases your risk of diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity. We need to do better with sleeping. So more good sermons from Dr. DeRose that put the audience to sleep is what we need. Okay, make dental health a priority. If you have good oral health, you'll have better blood fluidity. That's right. Oral health helps your circulation. If you've got gum disease, that puts inflammation in your body. I just saw a fellow in the office a few days ago having a lot of health issues. In fact, his heart had just gone into an abnormal heart rhythm. And he said, might it have anything to do with my mouth? An infection in his mouth, teeth in very bad shape. And I said, well, inflammation does, you know, feed into these circulatory problems. Achieve and maintain an ideal weight. We've talked enough about that. Controlling stress. Maybe we'll talk more about that tomorrow. You know, today's lectures were designed to create stress if you're not on a healthy lifestyle. Okay. Hopefully giving you some motivation to change. And then donating blood. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Well, we do need to wind up. I know some of you may have questions. And especially when someone close to the front row. Are you have a question, young man? Is that why you're raising your hand or you're just stretching? Okay, just stretching. I'm thinking we may be better off to have the questions individually. I'm not getting any other. I'm getting indications that that's the best plan. What we're going to do is we're going to have a prayer to close the Sabbath. And then Dr. Bryant is going to come up. He'll come up with a box of videos. And I'll tell you a little bit about what we have for you today. Oh, they're in the back? Okay. Those are back there. Are the books back there too? Okay. Well, let's have a word of prayer as we close. And if you have individual questions, I'll go out in the back. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we've been on a journey this Sabbath together, those of us who've been here from the morning hour. And we've basically looked and we've seen that the Bible speaks to us about health. But it speaks to us more than about just health as some abstract idea. It speaks about a God who loves his children, who loves each one of us here in this room, who loves each person on this planet, even if they don't acknowledge him, even if they're cursing him right now. And as we studied together, we saw that you are one who not only has created us in love, but you have instructed us and you've included in the pages of the scriptures the keys that point us in the direction of the healthiest lifestyle. We've seen that you've shown us such a lifestyle not just for our benefit, but you've called us to be kings and priests, sharing in the ministry of Jesus and ministering to the health of our families, our communities, our neighbors. I want to thank you again for the Three Angels Church. Thank you for what is happening right here in this building to reach the community. I pray that you'd give them special efficiency and effectiveness in reaching people in Wichita and beyond. And I pray for each one here in this room. As we've spoken about things about healthful living, it just reminds each of us we have room to grow, but help us to encourage one another. If we see someone who's struggling, not to point fingers, but to give them a strong shoulder, some encouragement, maybe bake them a healthy loaf of bread instead of condemning them for what we saw in their purse. Father, please help us to have grace as we encourage one another on this journey, and then help us take other people by the hand in our communities as we invite them to programs, as we invite them to our homes for healthy meals, as we study the Bible with them, study health material. Thank you that you give us the privilege of being co-workers with you. Bless us now as we go forth to share your grace with others. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.